So, immunological networks. It's mainly a blackboard session with few trans overheads. Ah, here is my collaborator. So it's very important that you interrupt us as soon as you have problems with vocabulary and many things, because immunology is quite a vast field, so you have to interrupt me. So immunology is a very, maybe it adds a lot of complexities because of these three aspects. What I call a information processing aspect, which is to treat, to react to the environment, which made of very variable pathogens, and to, for each pathogen, induce a response which is specific, which is spatially localized to the site of infection, and which is dense in a way that the organism must anticipate all possible pathogens that it never encountered before. Dense, it should be, if you have a hole in your immune repertoire, it's quite bad, so you must react to any kind of pathogens. So this, which is mainly based on antigen recognition receptors, as we will see, and signal processing in specialized cells, is a key, of course, interest for immunologists. But there is also this axis, which is for one individual, the immune system is a developing system, even in the adult, meaning that there is always a flow of newly dividing cells, which is produced and selected, organized into physiology. And these cells must learn to tolerate the self, so not to react against its own body cells. And this induces, we'll see, which is most famous, of course, which is immunological memory. So vaccination, you remember that you have been infected. But we must say now that this memory is not very intelligent. It is specific for the pathogen we have encountered. So you cannot, it's not because you have been vaccinated against the flu that you will react with another subtype of influenza virus, meaning that you don't use this memory to anticipate the recognition of new pathogens. It's just to protect you against the same infection with the same pathogen. So it's not like the brain memory which allows you to anticipate. It's not.
Where is the memory stored?
I will see that. It's a key question, of course. Okay, so that is the developmental aspect, which has its own complexity. We have seen already some examples in the sea ocean, and basically it's not very different. And at the species level, so in a population, I mean, we pass pathogens from one person to another, so there are mechanisms of diversity in our immune response that makes that the population is made resistant for one pathogen independently of the resistance of each individual. Meaning me, I can be sensitive, but if I'm protected, I will also protect you because I will not be contagious and so on. So there is a population-wide immunology, which is quite important in evolution. And the evolution of the immune system, okay, the evolution of new functions, new genes, cytotoxic genes and so on, deals with the diversity of the background of each individual, and of course with the robustness of the system. And the immune system is maybe one of the most redundant one in terms of pathways. So, you know, the interleukins, for instance, which many interleukins, which all binds the same kind of receptors. So No, I've got a problem here to begin with, because there is many kind of things to see. Maybe the more to a little bit answer the, your question. Yes. Yes.
So, for example, when American Indians were exposed to the disease and white men, within 1 or 2 decades,
yes, and maybe because there was a lot of killed people, so of course you will. I mean, the immune fitness is something which is very important. So
it evolves
very fast.
Your question rests in an error. You don't evolve a capacity to respond to certain pathogens except in rare cases. The whole idea of the system. That no matter which individual on Earth is exposed to no matter what pathogen, typically they will respond right away without evolution.
Mm-hmm.
Right. It's not that you need 5 generations to evolve a response, otherwise we'd be all dead.
So there's no evolution of the
human. There is, of course, but the typical response is not, and it's not like you go to another continent and there is a new bug. You don't have to wait 2 generations.
Sure.
If they're gross enough.
No, but when new population comes into contact with other populations,
yes, but what you see is the result of the selection, which is very efficient because, of course, it's little things, so it goes fast. So the immune system is a system. It means that you have a systemic immunity in the body. And when we talk about immune system, we talk about multicellular organism. And here we were talking about mammalians, especially humans. So this flow of new cells, new cells are generated, germline immune cells are in the bone marrow. And during the life, say, you have this flow of new cells here that eventually can maturate through specialized structures like the thymus, which will make the T cells, the famous T cells. And these cells populate what we call the periphery. So this is a real immune system, the functional one. This is a development. And this, at this periphery, basically you have at the border, which is the skin or the mucosa, you have a surveillance by specialized cells, which are now well-known, but which were not well-known 10 years ago, which are the dendritic cells, essentially. Dendritic. So there are dendritics, that means they make dendrites, which are quite long and make a real network of connection, not connections, but of density of membrane and so it's really a surveillance system. It's kind of filter. And then the signal, the information here is a pathogen. You have to process it. So these cells process the pathogen, migrate into the lymph nodes. The lymph nodes, you know, are a little bit everywhere. I don't have a map here. It's and there is a circulation here of the lymph into the lymph nodes, where the signals would be integrated by T cells, B cells. So here is the intelligent, that's the brain of the immune system. And of course, the goal is to induce effector mechanism that will be either recruited from elsewhere or generated and go back into the infection point. And these effector cells, okay, this is a little bit the military science aspect of in immunology, which is a little bit less noble than the information processing one. But we will say a few words. So that's basically how it works. And
I'm just curious, there are organisms without bone marrow, is that right? Like fish?
Yeah, I mean, the this system basically begins with the jawed fish in evolution. Jawed fish, yeah. So it's 600 to 700 million years, I think.
And fish actually has bone marrow.
Yes, I think so, yeah. Okay, but here we are talking about immune systems that have a kind of memory, so they generate basically these two intelligent cells, we'll say B cells and T cells. And of course, every organism has kind of immune system, even bacteria, which we can say that the restriction enzyme is kind of immune system against the viruses. So, but here we are talking about adaptive immune system, which are able to learn to have a memory inside for one individual. Yeah, sea ocean has quite interesting molecules, exactly, and dosophilia too. So, yes, we should say here that the key point is here. The key point is a barrier with the environment. And you know that we synthesize a lot of, lysozyme, a lot of things which are toxic for bacteria. And the skin itself, when there is a lesion, so eventually an infection, emits the first signal. So the first signal that initiates the immune system comes from non-immune cells. It comes from keratinocytes, things like this, which says basically, look out, there is something here coming. And this is known as, we'll see that as the initial inflammatory events, which is mediated by NF-kappa-B transcription factors and things like this. So now we'll come back a little bit to the specificity problem. So basically, which kind of receptors allow the body to recognize the pathogens? So before to go to the noble part, which are antibodies and T-cell receptors, let's talk a little bit about what we call the innate immunity. So we have germline encoded receptors, which are able to recognize pathogens, specific structures and pathogens, structures which are not evolving because they are central features of the bacteria, for instance, of viruses. So we call that the pathogen-associated molecular patterns. And these are basically lipids. For example, lipid A, which is a component of the lipopolysaccharides. Some sugars, which are specific for bacteria or yeast. Basically, it's non-cellulated sugars because mammalian cells may cellulate their sugars. And it's double-strand RNA. Double-strand RNA is the result of the replication of RNA and some DNA viruses. So it's an initial mechanism by which the body can recognize that there is a microorganism, basically. So double-strand RNA, for instance, if you have an infected cell in your body, any cell, virtually, a virus will make this double-strand RNA, which binds to enzymes, kinase, and induce a cascade, and will synthesize the interferon systems, okay, alpha and beta. And this interferon acts a little bit inside the cells to limit the replication of the virus, but mostly acts as a signal to the immune cells so they can be, they know that the cell is infected. So that's a very important system, which is probably very old in evolution. And these, there is plenty now of receptors which are known, but quite recently, because this was not a very interesting part of the immunology for long. But now we are discovering quite a lot of these receptors, mainly the toll family, which is related to some molecules in Drosophila and so on. So it's quite old system of recognition of the biochemical signature of the pathogens. So initiation begins always by the recognition of this kind of structure. We'll see after how it's organized into the information processing. So now let's talk about the noble part of the antigen receptors, which are basically antibodies. Okay, that's an antibody. And the question, of course, which has interested a lot immunologists, is how can we generate high diversity of antibody molecules from very few number of genes? So the answer is that we have a system of recombination of many viable fragments of antibodies. So here there is a viable regions. For instance, in human, I have the data somewhere here. Okay, here it's the organization of the locus. So antibody has a heavy chain, the light chain. The heavy chain, you have 40 viable regions, which are little mini genes, if you want, which are after recombined at the DNA level. So it's really a recombination. Recombined with one D fragment for diversity and junction fragment here to make this contiguous DNA, which is the viable part of the heavy chain, which stands here, of course, because here is the site for antigen binding. Okay, we have also light chains that comes here, which are recombined with the same system. Okay. Sorry? Yeah, this is a heavy chain. It's heavy, it's 75 kilo Dalton, and this is 25.
Are you or Doran alone describe how this rearrangement?
No. Maybe Doran, you can.
So the answer is yes.
What?
Because you asked whether you or me will describe it. So, yeah,
I guess. You will do it? So it's quite complex.
You already show it, but I can describe it.
I mean, at the molecular level, it's a quite complex system with specialized proteins. So basically, there is a number of signal sequences.
I have a couple of slides for this.
You have slides?
Yeah.
Okay, so we...
But there is information here which I don't have, so it would be nice to get it when I come to it.
Okay. We'll see that how... We'll see later how it's organized into the development of B cells and T cells, but basically, you come with this rearranged DNA, which is expressed as pre-mRNA. There is a processing here to link the viable part to the constant part, which have common function, and you've got to you arrive to the protein. Okay, this rearrangement is quite it can generate a high diversity of receptors, which is estimated here in human, something like 10 to the 10. It's a little bit costly. I mean, it has a cost, which is you can generate a lot of non-functional chains, because at this junction here, you have the possibility to make a non-precise junction. So it can be one, two, or three nucleotides, and this generates random diversity. But of course, this also generates frame shifts and bad chains. So there is a whole system in the B cell maturation that allows this kind of checkpoints. The B cell first make a heavy chain, try a heavy chain with a kind of standard light chain. If this step is okay, it makes the light chain and so on. And it appeared recently. I mean, the basic hypothesis was, okay, we make chains and then we select. We select the B cells. I mean, the B cells are selected. We'll see that after. But now it appears that there is a kind of addition of the receptors, meaning that if the receptor don't, I mean, if this antibody, which is at the beginning a receptor, doesn't fit with what, I mean, with non-self recognition and eventually recognition of a pathogen, it's edited, meaning that some V regions can be modified, can be exchanged by another one. So it's a kind of second chance. This is quite new. I mean, a few years ago, we didn't know that this was happening. So it's called receptor editing. Yes. Any heavy? Yeah. Sorry. These two heavy are the same. These two light. I mean, the binding sites are the same. So it's the same light and the same heavy. But any light can match with any heavy chain.
And that's because messenger RNA leaves twice.
So no. No, no. That's at the protein level. I mean, they have light chain of an affinity for. Yeah.
Make a lot of protein copies from this messenger.
Right.
So the light chain has a natural affinity for the heavy chain. So whatever you put, it will stick together.
One picture of a protein?
That's a protein. No, that's a protein. yeah, I'm sorry, it's so standard for us, the antibody shape. But so, yeah, it's not very well explained here. We'll see the picture. Yeah. Here. No. I have a DR. Can you switch it on? Exactly. The black one? So this is this corresponds to this fragment, okay? This is a crystal structure of what we call a fragment antigen binding, which is only one, so it has been cut because it's easier to crystallize. And you see the two chains here. So that's a constant domain of the whatever chain, I don't know, heavy or light, and what's the variable domain. And here we have three loops, which are called the complementary determining region, which binds, which are in contact with the antigen, which is here, a lysosine molecule. Okay? And you have the same with the light chains. So how it works? The two first complementary regions turns into the VH domains. And the third one overlaps the end of the domain VH here and the D and the G. So it's highly variable and the major domain for variability.
So actually only one chain.
One and the other is in green there. Yeah. Okay?
Which one is telling
you? I don't know in this picture. I'm sorry. Yes, exactly. This long part here, which is constant and non-interesting, is not on this crystal structure.
So, on the table there, you listed the kappa, j kappa, and regions and all those things.
Mm-hmm.
But it seems like the only thing that really matters in terms of variability are the D and J segments. And that if you change around the B heavy fragment, that part, that's not changing the binding size, so that would not have any impact on the diversity of that antigen response.
Why do you say that?
Wait.
Isn't the B away from the business end of the protein?
No. The V has two regions here. Probably this one is the third one, which is the biggest and the more viable. But the V region contains already two antigen binding domains. So it's quite important for recognition. Okay?
You make a linear concatenation of V and J, or V, V and J, you make linear cropping, then we suppose some region of each of these segments gets to be in the area that interfaces with the antigen. So the binding site takes the composite residue that I'm containing in each and every one of those DNA segments.
There was one question that I thought you would come back to. You said that the two light chains are identical in the
yeah.
same
I mean, that's a dogma, yes. Mm-hmm. That is a dogma.
And the question is why? I mean, I guess you produce, the ribosome, you produce lots of these.
Okay.
Kinds of these. And they attach themselves, and on the same red one, you could have different groups. So
no, in one cell, okay, in one cell, there is only one recombination process. Okay, so in one cell, you will recombine only once the heavy chain and only once the light chain.
Uh-huh.
And it's even better than this, you will do that only on one chromosome because you have these two copies, paternal and maternal. And there is what is called allelic exclusion, meaning that once you have recombined one heavy chain, it blocks the recombination of the other locus on the other chromosome. So that's very tricky. I mean, this happens, I think, in other receptors too. Exactly.
Exactly. And this is called clonal exclusion. As Jean-Marc said, this also happens in other systems, in the olfactory system, in the nervous system, where there is a family of different proteins and only one is selected, like some cunning mechanism.
Yeah.
So what happens at the first stage that the DNA rearranges inside, you have this linear DNA, and you actually cut it into pieces and splice it together?
Yeah, it's a kind of splicing system with special enzymes which are called recombination-associated genes and which are expressed specifically in this kind of cells during this phase. But we have also seen recently that it was expressed a little bit later for the phenomenon which called now edition. So you make only one copy, but you can come once again. You can come once again. So, for instance, you have done the VH2, you have used the VH2 domains here. You have cut what's in the middle here. It's definitely lost from the DNA. But you can still use the VH1 if you want and replace the VH2. So it's possible to edit the receptor, but always clonally, meaning that it's only one receptor per cell.
Because if every cell were a mixture, there would be no reason to amplify any one.
Exactly.
In the presence of the antigen, and you want to be able to amplify the one you select.
Exactly.
And that's why it has to be done at the DNA level
rather than
the RNA level.
That's why it has to be one per cell. Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm. And that's why also you must have this allelic exclusion mechanism. So that's a dogma. In fact, it appears more and more that it's not completely true, especially for T cells, I would see. But okay, let's say that it's one cell, one receptor. So in B cells,
this kind of mechanism can occur in altering a number of
situation in terms of morality. Can it occur more widely? Like, do you mean normal for other cells that have sort of random variety structures?
I mean, it has been detected only in cells where there is a obvious reason for an advantage of clonality like this, for example, odor receptors or things like this. But normally, no, it only occurs there. This I don't know. No, the RAG system, it goes together with the jawed fish evolution. At the same level of the antibody genes and so in the fish.
Oh, wait, okay,
fish and birds, mammals and so on. Yeah.
Various J regions, various D regions, various kappa means light chain?
Kappa means kappa, but yeah, there is two locus of light chain if you want the kappa one and the lambda one. But depend on species, so okay.
Okay, the various J segments, various D segments, are they very similar to each other, or and just missing a change in the species here and there, or are they completely random?
I mean, they're not completely random because they must do a protein at the end which is in frame and so on. But they're quite random, yes.
That is what?
They're quite diverse. Okay. Quite diverse. And as you see here, N regions, which are the random regions, which are generated by the linkage mechanism, it's quite important for diversity, and it's probably here in estimation because we don't know exactly. Okay. So what's important here is that we can generate from the germline sequence something like 10 to the 10 different receptors.
So how does this map into the distinction between the framework region and the hypervariable?
Okay, this what you say is more precise. So inside the VH, you have framework regions that give the protein the structure, and hypervariable regions which corresponds to the region in interaction with the antigen. Okay.
So it's a little bit of each is hypervariable.
Exactly. Each VH has a framework. And each VH has its own CDL. So that's the germline diversity. Okay. In B cells, you have also a mechanism of let's call affinity maturation, meaning that there is a special system that makes mutation, high rates mutation into the variable regions. Okay, so once the cell has made its receptor, it can further undergo other mutations and maturate its antibody. So in terms of affinity, is that the whole picture? Okay, you start from a germline antibody, which is here. And it has given affinity for an antigen. And if you immunize repeatedly one animal, you will select higher affinity antibodies by single spot mutations. Okay? Up to there. And now what is known is that you can edit the receptor. So we can change the VH, for instance. You would jump, let's say, if you are not lucky here, but if you are lucky, you would jump here. And then you can go on affinity maturation. Go here. So that's all the abilities of the antibody to evolve under selective pressure with exon shuffling and point mutations.
What's the rate of point mutations?
I don't know. Have you data on this, Doron?
Maybe first we need the principle. The principle we are talking about point mutations, but they are not evolutionary point mutations. They are somatic point mutations. So there is a cell and it has undergone a decision to make a particular life and a particular behavior. So if the patient has been taken, now there is a mechanism which allows the clone of cells for different cells to express slightly different proteins. And this happens on a time scale of development, that is in days, hours and days. Cells divide and the progeny will make mutated receptors. And because, maybe can I say, there is one set of sentences that is extremely important for understanding the immune system in its entirety. And it's the idea of clonal selection. It's important, otherwise we don't understand. We understand practically nothing. The idea is that cells have DNA that is preordained 10 million years ago, and it is coding for a particular receptor. And these receptors get expressed on cells, and cells get selected according to whether or not they bind an antigen. This can happen for selecting a particular clone that has made a particular decision on VL combination. And it can also serve to select a particular mutant within a clone to be propagated further and extended more, thereby gradually generating more and more cells that have higher and higher things. But the mutation process is at the level of cells. So it happens all the time, as we talk. Our cells mutate and make better and better antibodies within a clone.
But this would not pass to the next generation.
And this does not pass to the next generation. Only the capacity to do so passes. The mechanism that we know.
So number is just sort of some ground-blind structure, and that structure is passed into our germ cells.
Yes.
And then there is a selective process.
Variations on the theme are then made on an individual basis, depending on antigen exposure, luck, and so on.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Well, if the answer is that there are specific mutagenic mechanisms that affect this particular and not others. So,
and you have it's a special mechanism and it's well known. You have a translocation. Do you remember which one it is? I don't remember which one it is, but you have a translocation that puts its system in front of genes that control the cell cycle. And this makes mutations. And then you have, I think it's lymphoma. Okay? That means that it's very important that this system of mutation is localized to this region of the genes. Otherwise, you have big problems. Okay?
In order to take advantage of these kinds of variations, you either need lots of cells.
Yeah,
or
so.
Rapid mutation. How fast do the cells?
Okay, we'll see that after, because there is two problems here. It's the selection during the development of the cell, which is basically has to avoid self-recognition, okay? And there is the more clonal selection, as Doron was saying, which is after contact with the antigen, how the clone expands and select for better affinity receptors. Time scales.
You don't have to go through the entire repertoire. The basic repertoire is about 10 to the 6, and it is amply represented within the body. So 10 to the 6 cells is only a milligram. So we have enough cells representing all flow. And maybe 10 to the 7 is 10 milligrams. And so there is enough, there are grams of tissue. So all cells are represented. And fine-tuning is done at top. So you don't have to roam through entire sequences.
Okay.
How fast?
How many generations?
Cell generation, few hours.
Now what you must know is that if you transfer one B cell progenitor, for instance, into an empty mouse, we can make empty mouse by irradiation. I mean, one cell can generate 10 to the 15 descendants. Okay. So with one cell you can repopulate millions of mice. Okay. So the proliferation power of these cells are very high. That's the first point.
The time scale can be obtained by the classical immunization procedure. The classical immunization procedure calls for injecting an antigen, and you get primary immune response within a day or two, and then it takes maybe a week or two until you really are immunized and you have memory cells.
Yeah,
so a matter of days, the whole system adjusts itself to what it needs to do.
On the order of 10 to 100 generations, is that what you're talking about? It's a few hours for one generation.
I mean, it's not very different of other cell systems. It's the division time is 24, 48 hours.
And so the division time is more than 2 hours, but the energy is
there. Yeah, it's one day.
And so maybe.
But it's not. The most important is not really the time scale, it's the size of the clone you will generate. And obviously when you have an immune response, you know that your lymph node inflates, and this is basically the expansion of clones, and that will give the diversity. And it appears in few days. Say. But this flow here, I mean, this is a very complex question you are asking for, because this flow here of cell, new cells, which are generated, new specificities, I mean, they come here into a full box of, I mean, it's full of cells here. There is an homeostasis of the whole system. All number of cells is constant. So they will replace cells which die. So it's not easy to answer because it depends on the rate of death of these cells here, basically. Okay, you have the same system on T cells. Maybe we should. Okay, here I have to draw a, because now with T cells it gets more complex.
So that was for
B cells. Antibodies. Okay. So we have to draw something about the T cells. And introduce a major histocompatibility complex molecules. So any of our cells express specialized molecules which are able to which express at the surface. When we synthesize proteins, protein synthesis here goes often cytoplasm, and there is a degradation process. Every protein has half-life with degradation, and there is a specialized structure which is called proteasome, which degrades the proteins into peptides, basically, and then the peptides will degrade further into amino acids and so on. So this proteasome is coupled with a transporter system, the TAP system, transporter associated with antigen processing, that is able to take this peptide from the cytoplasm, transfer it into the endothelium reticulum, into the reticulum endoplasmic reticulum, sorry, where it meets this MHC proteins, class 1. So that's a major histocompatibility complex class 1. Okay, let's call them MHC1. The terminology is historic and okay. So it meets these proteins, binds to them and be exported at the surface. Of course, that's a very important process because that means that any virus, any organisms that synthesize some proteins into a cell, so any pathogens being there, will be betrayed or can be seen from the outside through this mechanism. So that's an intracellular surveillance mechanism that allows antigenic peptides, but also self-peptides. Be aware that there are all the peptides which are degraded in the cells goes up here to the surface. So you have self-peptides and you have antigenic, I mean pathogen peptides. So peptide. So these peptides, the peptides that binds to MHC molecules, something between 8 and 12 amino acids, which is not, which if you think is not very stupid because it's in the range of high specific sequence. So the specificity of the MHC proteins is complex. Basically, you can say it binds like this. Here is a peptide. You have anchor residues. This is a very simplified view. But you are generally anchor residues, which are important, generally two or three. The others are three. I mean, you can put what you want. So each MHC molecule is specific for a peptide family that exhibits, let's say, anchor residues. So for instance, hydrophobic here in second position, charge basic or charge acid in a eighth position, and it varies. It varies, why? Because MHC is very polymorphic, and we express, each of our cells express six different MHC class 1 molecules, because there are three locus and two alleles. So in human, we have HLA A, B, and C, okay? So that makes three locus, paternal, maternal. We have six different kinds of MHC class 1 molecules here, meaning that we can present quite a good deal, a good fraction of the peptides to the cell surface.
This lineage is random or in stages, there are distinct stages?
Yeah.
Say size-wise?
It's the enzymes here that cleave the peptides. It's not completely random. You have preference for lysines, for instance. I mean, like a lot of enzymes. But what happens here is that you can have a trimming mechanism, that you can bind eventually larger peptides, and then you cleave the ends. So at the end, it's a little bit skewed, the repertoire of peptides which are presented. It's not exactly random, but it's quite diverse.
Size-wise, they start with big chunks or they tune from the end?
I mean, that depends on the MHC molecules too. It's not very clear yet what's exactly the specificity of the two, but maybe, okay.
The end of that today, the end, you either have size 1 or N minus 1, you don't get the peptide test.
Correct.
Correct.
So that diversity of MHC now is on top of the level of diversity that we need. And so that there's a big pressure to diversity of
exactly. I mean, this is
body, but not at this level. Like here we're talking.
Sorry? No, there is a big pressure for diversity here at the level of MHC. Okay, but it's now at alleles. Yeah. Ah, yes. This, in one individual, you have one given MHC background. One and two also. We'll see that after. But each of us are different, as known by the tissue transplantation problems. Okay? And HLA-A alleles are maybe... We'll see after, but we know that MHC is diverse and everybody is different from tissue transplantation experiments.
Yeah, let's say just one sentence. This system that is now being described here is not an antigen receptor, because immediately there is another antigen receptor called the T cell receptor that can come to the line. What this will get the attention of. I know it's separate. So, this is just a presentation mechanism, and nature has decreed that the presentation mechanism would not be very diverse.
but will be very individual. So each person has a different kind of display mechanism, embodied in a set of things selected from a few dozen or even a hundred or more different possibilities. So each of you is different with its exoplanet of an NFC model.
Mm-hmm.
They all display that a second set of phenomena associated with its exoplanet, because we are all different. And these proteins are displayed on the surface of most of our body cells. It makes for an idiosyncratic signature of individuality. And if you take a tissue from one person and stick it into another by tissue transplantation, it will be immediately recognized as foreign. This is the most important determinant in individual difference when tissue gets transplanted, because otherwise, most of the cells are all of us look the same. So there are two different phenomena, and they are intricately related to each other. One, the recognition of cell, and the other, antigen presentation. Two functions in the
same. Yeah, we'll see that with the T cell receptor, but let's say this is really presentation molecules, okay? And it's diverse, it's really to imagine why it's diverse. It's because if it was not diverse, virus would have evolved to avoid these sequences. And okay, if you have no peptide that binds to MHC, you will not be seen by the T cells here outside, and the virus can go cool. So,
but with retrovirus, it seems that the evolutionary rate is so fast that you could avoid the HLC within a matter of days or months or whatever.
Yeah, that's true. That's when you're infected with a retrovirus, especially HIV, you tend to develop mutants that avoid MHC presentation, of course. But okay, you have six MHC, and the virus has functions that there is a kind of pressures to, I mean, it's contradictory with the maintenance of the viral function. So it's not so frequent, okay? But of course, if virus have the occasion to avoid this, they try. And a lot of virus also downregulates the expression of the MHC molecules, which is the first target of the virus response to the immune system, I mean, in the evolution. So virus has developed proteins that inhibit either the transport or the export of the MHC molecules. So now we have the antigen here. The antigen, which is recognized by T cells, is this complex here of the peptide and the MHC molecules. Okay? So the T cell receptor recognizes this. So it has a part of specificity for the MHC molecule itself and a part of specificity for the presented peptide, as we can see of the same diapositive. Yeah? Close now, maybe. No, it was a previous one. Okay. So what you see here, so very similar structures and for antibodies. Same principle, heavy chain, light chain, and so on. But the interaction occurs with the MHC molecules here. So the MHC molecules, you can see the what we call the groove, which corresponds to the hole here where the peptide can go inside. It's like the sausage into the hot dog, I would say. Okay. And the peptide, antigenic peptide, is here. And the TCR with the complementary determining regions here interacts both with the MHC and the peptide. Okay? So the recombination of the T cell receptor is exactly like for the antibody. You have variable regions. So you have two chains in the T cell receptor, alpha and beta. We will not consider the gamma and delta, which are, forget it. So you have the alpha, the beta chain, the alpha chain, and let's take the beta chain, it's simple. V regions, diversity, joining region, constant region. Okay? So basically you can make the same thing like with antibodies or combine, and you get a diversity in the same range, 10 to the 10. So to answer the question of, so this recombination here in T cells, but it's true also in B cells, occurs during the transfer of cells. So in T cells, it occurs here in the thymus, where the chains are rearranged and expressed. So we've got precursors, stage one, a lot of things here, we don't care. And at the end, we've got T cells with alpha beta chains. We begin by TCR beta rearrangement, and then TCR alpha. Okay, there is a, immunology is trying to phenotype all these cells so we can try to detect which pre-T cells, pro-T cells, and so on. So it's controlled by the thymic environment. And maybe after the pause, we can see how the T cells are selected on B cells, are selected not to be cross-reactive with the self, and how it can generate a kind of dense repertoire to anticipate the presence of further pathogen. But before the pause, a little bit of diapositives about antibody specificity, which is always amazing. Where is it? Yeah. Can you put it on, please? So the number of contact here. You see, okay, that's the two chains of the antibody. That's only the antigen binding domains. So the all the constant domains have been taken out. So it's what we call a fragment variable. So it's basically the CDR here. And that's the number of contact of the two chains with the lysozyme. So it's 66 and 35 contact, which is really quite a lot. And if we go the specificity of antibodies, you have got an example here. We've made an antibody against a chelate with a metal inside. Okay? So a chelate, you know, is this kind of cage with carboxylic acids, and you have a metal which is inside the chelate. And you see the power of selection, which makes, and we obtain an antibody with a histidine that will coordinate the metal inside exactly as in the best enzymatic systems. So you can generate, here you have the structure of this complementary determining region, interaction with the chelate. It is a metal here, and the coordination. Meaning that you can really, and this antibody is specific, I mean, can recognize the metal which is inside the chelate. So the specificity you can get with antibodies is really, you can get what you want, basically. Just a matter of size. So the size is 700 square angstrom. So that's the size, you cannot go further. Okay. Pause.
What I will try to do is to fill in some details that are important for understanding, from a more physical point of view, what we are talking about. So, are more people coming? Is there any recruitment process? Oh, if Eitan came, then I can really begin. Okay. No, I need your questions. So, first, what is the immune system all about? I would like to ask the attention of the audience, please. what? Yes, exactly. Come in. let people come in. we lost one of the lectures. What is the immune system all about? The immune system is about responding to anything that comes in. So basically, in evolution, and this happened over hundreds of millions of years, organisms developed means of responding to the environment, responding to what people sometimes call xenobiotics. That is, whatever is foreign is not found in the body and should typically be fought because it may wreak havoc in the body. Now, the body works along these principles that we have already discussed before. So the question is, if you make an enzyme for a substrate or a receptor for a ligand, that's very easy. But how do you make a receptor for everything? We have already seen this problem in the olfactory system. The answer is make a repertoire. A repertoire should be large enough so that probabilistically, without fine-tuning as we heard before, but at least as a first tier of defense, there will be a receptor for anything that comes in, be it a virus with its coat proteins, or a bacterium with its idiosyncratic proteins on its surface, or a snake toxin, or anything else. So you make many receptors that fit perhaps not as nicely and snugly as this key and lock fit, but they fit enough to get going. Yes, I'm sure.
If I think of, for example, the native populations that are badly affected by viruses from
the
okay. Is that something that.
There is a certain mix up here. Self is you. And you is different for different people, slightly different, but by and large it's more or less the same, and the immune system learns, and this is really learning from birth on. You start with a repertoire that could, in principle, work against yourself. This is a completely different story that I will not touch upon except by saying a sentence of principle. The immune system learns to tell self from non-self, and it learns not to react to self and only to react to non-self. And it's an interesting mathematical problem. How do you tease away in shape space the self versus non-self? But let's leave this apart because this is a modulation of the repertoire. You can inactivate certain clones or certain combinations of light and heavy chain and so on and leave others going on. So you need to make enough receptors to recognize the antigen. And as mentioned already, olfactory receptors and antibodies, which are antigen receptors, but the word antigen typically means something that causes an immune response. The word antibody is a protein that was already recognized around the turn of the century to be soluble, roaming in the body, in the serum, in the blood, and capable of recognizing foreign substances. So you'd be able to show that there are proteins in the serum that coat bacteria or agglutinate, aggregate by way of them being bivalent. If there is an antigen here, an antigen here, and if the antigen itself is multivalent, you get an aggregate. This is a very old phenomenon that was studied by immunologists like Landsteiner and so on. And so there is a capability of antibodies to recognize antigens, and you can measure this very clearly and show that there is a specific immune response and that different antigens. Jean-Marc said this was sort of a drawback of the system, that if you immunize with A, you don't get a response for B. Of course you don't get a response for B. The whole idea is that it should be specific, otherwise you wouldn't be able to tell self versus non-self, and otherwise you wouldn't be able to home on specific bacteria that infect you right now as opposed to whatever happens next year. So there should be specificity. But it's a multiple specificity. It could be that one cell will respond to several antigens and vice versa. And actually, when you inject an antigen, you get what is known as a polyclonal response. Dozens of different antibodies get elicited. Yes? Okay. Now, there are some limits on what is an antigen. Very often it's a peptide, but very often it's a glycosylated peptide. So sugars are very, very good antigens. DNA, RNA, and lipids are not very good antigens, but they get responded against, as mentioned, in this primordial immune response, antibody-less immune response, but that's besides the point. Mostly for antibodies, it's proteins, glycosylated proteins, and the folding actually gets recognized, so the exact configuration, and this is actually shown in one of the next slides. So, this I will skip. I mean, this is just to mention.
the antibody, before you, I have the impression that each of the cells displays these things. This is the receptor.
Right, it will come. It will come. Eitan, it's coming. It's coming. Let me skip this. Let me get to the principle. So, here is an antigen, a folded protein. On its surface, there may be certain regions that protrude or have a very distinct signature, such as a charge or hydrophobicity or something like that. These are called antigenic determinants. And different proteins in different people can have different portions behave and act as antigenic determinants. And when you get an immune response, this is simple-mindedly shown with three antigenic determinants, and here are the antibodies that recognize it. And yet, as you can see, you get a network that brings this down. And this is one of the important aspects of the immune response. Take soluble small proteins, cross-link them, make an aggregate which can easily be cleared and neutralized. That's not the only way by which antibodies work, but it's one of the ways. So this antigen will elicit several different antibodies of different types, but even this round shape can elicit response of several different sort of good fit antibodies. So an antigen can elicit dozens or even hundreds of different kinds of antibodies in what is known as polyclonal response. About monoclonal antibodies, I will speak in a few moments. So now the question is, we already learned that there are antibodies sort of waiting in the system to be recognized by the antigens and to be told, do something. And this will come to light immediately. So we make all of these antibodies and they are sitting there waiting. This is in some more detail what an antibody looks like. So now we can really discern very clearly the... where is Richard? Is he here? He's gone. I mean, I will have to show him it individually. Okay, so this is the light chain. This is the heavy chain. Each of these circles is actually a folded domain that looks like that. So there is a very clear folding pattern for all the immune domains, and it's dominated by beta sheets with loops. And there is a single preserved disulfide bond that holds the system together. And here you see those loops. This is where the antigen binding site is. So you can recognize that because the protein folds and meanders, it could be that different loops get contributed by different genetic genomic segments that get put together to make the final coding region. So what do we have? We have a light chain and a heavy chain. First, why do we have a light chain and a heavy chain? Scientists always ask why. Biologists always ask, how is it? Physicists ask why, because biologists are also scientists to some degree. So what you see here is there are two chains, and they both have antigen binding regions. And you already learned this, but I want to highlight it in as clearly as possible a way that the combinatorics at the protein level are the first tier of combinatorics that is extremely important. If you only made each chain from one gene, the yellow parts, maybe first I have to say, yellow parts are variable, blue parts are constant. So the constant parts, for the purpose of what we are talking about now, there is only one kind. There are actually several, but never mind. So there is one kind of constant heavy, say, and one kind of constant light, but many kinds of yellow guys. And if you make many kinds of yellow guys, and at the protein level you do combination of light and heavy, you get a square of the number. So if you have 100 of these yellows and 100 of these yellows, you get 10,000 different varieties. And we know that by and large, each light and each heavy can combine together to make a protein. So this they do basically because this interface here is absolutely constant. And in this region, there is what Jean-Marc called the framework. So this yellow has ultra yellow at the tip and slightly less yellow here. So there is enough constancy to make the two variable regions stick together in a universal fashion so as to display the non-universal parts on the top. So light and heavy are a mechanism of generating diversity. Now, the fact that there is a blue part is because the antibody has to do much more than bind antigen. It has on occasion to be stuck on the membrane or it has to interact with other components that elicit an immune response. So the blue parts do transduction, as we usually call it, or the immune system people will call it effector function, and this does recognition. What else do I have to show in this picture? Well, there are sugars, all proteins are glycosylated, that's not important. This is about 25 kilodalton long, this is 50 to 70 kilodalton long, but you see that these domains repeat themselves, so they appear to have arisen by gene duplication. There is a good homology between the variable region and the constant region. So they are variants of each other, except that the yellow guys started perhaps from one kind and then at the evolutionary level made many, many copies strung along DNA. Now to Eitan's question. The typical behavior of immunoglobulins, and this we are talking about two kinds of immune receptors, immunoglobulins, nicked also B cell kind of of antibodies, and there is the T cell receptors that we will talk about later, already mentioned before. So an immunoglobulin, with all its glory, can come in two varieties, soluble and membrane bound. And this is extremely important as an operating principle of the immune system, because the antibody begins its life as membrane bound, so there are cells, more and more and more cells, coated with different kinds of antibodies. As mentioned already, each cell, each individual cell, only makes one specific antibody as a matter of principle. Exceptions always exist. So cells coated with antibodies roam around. An antigen comes and it titillates the antibody molecule so as to say something to the cell. And what it says to the cell is proliferate. So the most, if there is one principle you have to know about the immune system, it is that of clonal selection. That is, there are many, many, many kinds of cells. The antigen comes and there are, let's say, 10 million different types of cells. It selects 10 out of them by binding. There is nothing intelligent about it. It binds. And every time that there is a binding event, this cell will begin to give rise to progeny. And all the progenies are as committed as the original cell to make the exact same type of antibody. So, yes?
Now, imagine before there is a distribution of
the... Yes. So it works on the tail of the distribution. So what happens is that it is the red and the orange that gets mainly gets excited. What you're asking is whether high affinity will proliferate more than low affinity. Typically, it's a threshold, but there may be a gradation. I don't know the details, but it's an interesting question. Okay, I have to not to be too long because I have to let Jean-Marc come back. So this is the operating principle. And here in all its glory is what the immune system really does. You start from cells that have antibodies on their surface. And when you do first exposure to antigen, you get some soluble... Oh, I didn't mention one more important fact. One has to be very careful. The cells, when proliferating, undergo certain differentiation steps to begin to secrete and make soluble antibodies of the exact same type that they have been coated with initially. So then a proliferating clone of B cells, the ones that make soluble antibodies, will populate the blood with a very large number of copies of the antibody which was originally on the surface. And then there is another step in which the maturation comes in and some other important things that give rise to a secondary response upon secondary exposure. That's why we inject when we immunize, we inject more than once. So there is a first step, get the first tier immune response, inject second time, you get better immune response because of these somatic mutations that we mentioned and so on, and we also get much more proliferation. Now, between here and here there is memory. That is, if you inject once and you go through all of this, there is sort of a sidetrack that keeps some of these cells so that while in the first time you get exposed to an antigen, you have to undergo repeated exposure, and the system is a little slower, the next time around, if the exact same antigenic determinant comes in, the response is much faster. And this is what saves our lives most of the time.
Is that
what?
Is that
it's rather long. But do you know how long it lasts, Jean-Marc? Okay. Okay. So. Yeah, go ahead.
Okay. I have a naive question. Evolutionary theorists would tell you that energies would want to evolve in such a way as to be as secret as possible.
Yes. Like a stealth airplane.
Yeah. So is there an indication of this?
There are indications. And one of the stories of the T-cell response is about that. One of the ways to stealthily get into your body and stay there without being detected is to get into your own cells. Hence, that other system that tells the body it's not an antigen that roams around outside the cells, but lurking inside the cell, there is something that needs to be destroyed. Therefore, it gets processed, displayed in the context of MHC, as mentioned before, and attacked by this parallel system called the T-cell receptors. But there are other ways. Viruses such as HIV or trypanosomes, parasites, know how to change their coat day to day so as to show a different set of antigenic determinants every time they come in. And also influenza viruses do that. All of these influenza viruses that come from the Far East, every time they look different. He's unhappy about something. Okay, what do immunoglobulins do? Many times they tag, and this may be a bacterium, this large circle, a segment of which is seen here. The system has already recognized its proteins as foreign. It made antibodies against. They bind to these are soluble antibodies. They bind to the surface of the cell, and then they recruit. We have already heard about many cascades in transcription and so on. This is one other cascade in which subtle interactions among many, many components end up with generating a hole. Is it shown here, actually? Yeah, hole in the membrane. But actually, these proteins make the hole. They stick themselves into the membrane and make a hole. A hole for a cell is a kiss of death. Why? Yeah, you get things leak out and you get what is most important is that the ionic composition is very different outside than inside, and the cells die immediately when the ionic compositions internally get changed. So this kills the bacteria. So this, by the way, is called the complement system. All of these little things are the complement system. They recognize part of the constant region of the antibody, as shown here, and then a chain of events happens to generate a hole. I promised to say something about monoclonal antibodies. Are you going to say this, Jean-Marc, or shall I say? Okay. So usually when you inject antigen, you get many different antibodies. As physicists, you wouldn't like to study mixtures. You want to crystallize for X-ray crystallography. You want to do ligand binding, titrations. You want to understand something very clearly. So you need a single antibody. How do you make that? Anytime you inject antigens, you get many. So there was a very interesting method that was invented by Nobel laureate Cesar Milstein that has to do, without details, with fusing two types of cells, ending up in vitro, in the test tube, with a large population of immune cells all making the same antibody with a specificity that is requested by the investigator. So you actually immunize an animal, you extract heterogeneous populations of cells that all respond to the same antigen, and then you do a cloning, basically, of teasing out one clone of cells, proliferating it, and getting a very nice population that only makes one type of antibody. So this is a diversion. Just if you ever hear the word monoclonal antibodies, you'll know what this means. Okay, now a few words, maybe just to highlight more details on what we already heard from Jean-Marc about how this comes about in terms of DNA to RNA to protein. The immune system is extremely unusual in one sense, and that is that while most proteins are made, as you already have heard, ad nauseum, by starting with DNA and going through RNA, at which point segments of RNA get spliced together, called exons, to make a mature transcript, which then codes for protein. So we know this already. DNA is an inert bystander. It only codes. It never undergoes changes of a profound way or of a profound nature by putting pieces together, except in evolution, from one generation to another. But somatically, it usually doesn't undergo changes, except in the immune system. In the immune system, there is a process called DNA rearrangement. And we have already heard this, but I just want to give you some of the nomenclature and highlight the principle. We already understand that in order to make a mature antibody chain, this is the heavy chain, you need, or that's how nature decided to do it, to make it piecemeal. The green part is boring, that's the constant part, and the variable part, apparently in evolution it started with blue only, but then to make for even more combinatorial diversity, the purple and the yellow were added, the D and J for heavy chain and only J for light chain. So, and these are the approximate sizes. So most of the variable region is made blue, and there are small segments that are added on but play an important part in the folding in generating the antibody bind, the antigen binding site, which are these little things here. Although they look on the bottom, they end up at the tip of the molecule upon folding. So what happens at the DNA level? There are cassettes of greenies and yellows and purples and blues, and one is selected from each cassette. And at the DNA level, there is a joining of this, say, to that, to this, and they actually jump the way in haphazard way. So you can cut and paste here to here, or you can cut and paste from here to there. And it's now quite obvious why it's an irreversible phenomenon, because once you cut and paste a particular point in the middle of the cassette of blues into a particular point in the middle of the cassette of purples, there is no way back. That's a new DNA that gets generated, and it's a terminal decision for the cell line to only make an antibody that is V5D3J1, for example.
So in this particular case, the exact correspondence between the domains and the exon?
Yeah, they actually generate together an exon. This is an important point, Terry. Yeah. At this unusual DNA rearrangement process, we generate an axon, a de novo axon, which is composed of what originally was separate points in the DNA.
So the V corresponds, what piece of the V corresponds to one piece of exon? Several pieces of exon?
Exons, there is this exon and that exon. Okay. The definition of exon is only when looking at the RNA level, what ends up in the mature RNA and what doesn't. And it's a twofold definition. It has to be a It has to be a continuous piece in the premature transcript that ends up spliced to some other of its kind in the mature transcript. So therefore, this alone is not an exon. It's a part of an exon.
So up there, the top line, the coding region
Yes. So here there is this is sort of intergenic. This is intergenic, and then after you make this, then this is an intron which gets spliced out to make this final. Initially, like in all proteins, this gets it transcribed. This never gets transcribed. So this. It's random. This decision is random. Oh, how does it decide which part to transcribe? We learned this already. In front of this, somewhere, there must be a region that tells, I guess, I'm not sure, but I guess in front of every one of those, there is a region that says transcribe here.
Yeah, I'm not asking that. I'm asking, if you have long DNA,
yes?
The transcription does read everything here. That's
well, okay, it appears as if, do you know the answer, Jean-Marc?
No.
It appears that so maybe there is the decision making process that says recombination first, transcription later. No recombination, no transcription.
So like in my skin cells, it would have all of these.
Yes, exactly.
And
yes.
Yes.
This is how it was discovered by Tonegawa. He actually compared DNA from your skin to DNA from your lymphocytes, and he saw that the DNA is different, which is very, very unusual. Yes. So
when is this done?
Well, at the time that the B cells mature. So in the lineage, as B cells mature, this happens, and they end up making only one kind.
What's the mechanism?
What?
The stem cells start with all of them like that.
Yeah. Yes. So the DNA of a mature cell would look like this. This is the DNA of a mature cell, which then gets copied into RNA, which then gets spliced, which then gets translated. Yes?
I think the source of the confusion is when does recombination occur. From my understanding, limited biology, recombination will only occur when the cell divides. Is that correct?
It happens in the lineage, in the division steps of the lineage that leads to B cells, to mature B cells. Yeah, maybe there is a good picture there. So here it comes. Here it comes. Okay, the answer is yes. Is there any point that remains unclear? The answer is yes, you're right. And here... and let me say this, you may or may not be right, and for the utter principle, it doesn't matter. There is a process that involves several cell divisions, and at one point along this process, maturation occurs, and a commitment to making only one combination like this is made. This is important.
But once it's committed, when it divides again, it only makes that.
Exactly, because it's in the DNA. It's already in the DNA. That's the beauty of the system.
The rest of it has just lost, so what happened to the rest of it?
It's lost. The intervening sequences, like if you jump from here to there, this is lost. Okay, I'm all... So there is a mechanism, actually, that says once you have undergone a process of rearrangement, don't do more. And this, there is a feedback mechanism that says to the cell, I have already undergone rearrangement. And there is a feedback, actually, from the level of the protein. It comes back and says, I already have a protein made. Don't do anything more.
How about this random number? The cell doesn't only use a random number generator.
Yeah. What's the problem? It makes a random library. Let me finish a couple more slides, and Ron Mark, I'll let you come back to the arena. So the T cells, we have heard about T cells. The guys that make antibodies are called B cells. This is because of an organ called bursa of Fabricius in chickens. But never mind, don't remember that. So B cells make antibodies, soluble antibodies. It was recognized early on that they are not alone. That is, there is some other population of cells that help make antibodies. And this is how T cells were discovered first. Without much ado, I will just say that in the process of ending up with cells that know how to produce soluble antibodies, T cells, helper T cells, participate in recognizing certain portions of the antigen. And they do so in a way different from what B cells do. And this is where the MHC comes in, and this was already discussed. So they first were discovered as helping, but then it was discovered that there is a cellular immunity. So there is humoral immunity with soluble antibodies and cellular immunity, which is that T cells, without secreting anything, attack as cells. The missile here is the cell in its entirety. They attack the antigen. And this cellular immunity is the T-cell based immunity. So T-cells have two different functions, helping B-cells and making their own immune response, cellular immune response. And just to give an idea, there is a lot of commonality in structure among all of these proteins. This is the glorious antibody. This is a special kind of antibody that actually has three domains on each side here. Some have two, some have three. And this is a T-cell receptor. You see again the same constant variable arrangement, but it's monomeric. It's not dimeric. The dimerism, this dimeric shape, is solely for cross-linking. And it's an extremely important feature of the immune system, that it knows how to cross-link and generate generate three-dimensional precipitates. This one doesn't need it because it's on the surface of cells, so it's monomeric. And this guy is the guy that presents the antigen to this one. And it also comes in two varieties, already spoken about class 1. Class 2 does something slightly different. Okay, now these molecules sit on all cells and they serve, already mentioned, as some kind of a fingerprint of our individuality, but they also have a second function, which is to present antigen to these guys. And already mentioned, at least in passing, that the reason for that is that this system composed of this and that, which come on two different cells. That's important. This is disposed on one kind of cell, which absorbs antigens, breaks it down, makes pieces out of it, sticks it while this protein folds. While it folds, it sticks the peptide in the crevice of the binding site, and then it makes the protein go to the membrane and show, here is what I have inside. And then another type of cell comes in which has these receptors on it, and it touches upon this first type of cell, and then the recognition occurs, and this cell gets titillated to make progeny just like what we had here. So it's the same principle.
Why do we need to have different MHC? Why is it?
Okay, that's a very interesting question. You want to say that? Okay, so let me see if I have one more slide. If not, I think not. So, Jean-Marc, I'm done. You take this.
So back to thank you for a bit more structure. So back to the function now. Okay, we have seen essentially this part, which is the generation of the variety of receptors. Darren spoke a little bit about the contact with the antigen, so which is basically occur in lymph nodes. So what I want to do now is to see how this information is processed from the entry of the pathogen to the lymph node and how it's integrated by T and B cells in a positive or negative way. So my overheads are really disgusting. I'm sorry. This is black stuff. Okay, we have seen that the initiation is based on the recognition of some biochemical structure of the pathogens that are common, and these are innate immunity. And the very initial step is stimulation of the endothelial barrier, epithelium or mucosa or whatever. Even coagulation can stimulate the immune system. So you've got chemokines, interleukines, etc., which say that these dendritic cells, which are recognized now as a major cell of the immune surveillance, to phagocyte these pathogens here and to degrade them and to present the peptides, to load oneself with the antigen, so with the information, basically. Okay, and this now, cells, once they are loaded with antigen, will migrate to the lymph nodes, where the signal will be read by the T cells and the B cells. You've got also a process for bringing the particulate pathogens, particles, whatever, or even soluble proteins through the lymph flow to the, so that's very physiological and it's just dynamics, to the lymph nodes. Okay? So what now occurs inside the lymph nodes is quite complex, but basically based on the interaction of these three intelligent cells. We're going to see into detail. So the dendritic cell is loaded. It's loaded with pathogen peptides, basically, but not only peptides, can also be little lipids, and there is MHC molecules, there is classical molecules, but there is also non-classical, a lot of molecules that can present other things than peptides, small lipids, glycolipids, and everything like this. But basically, the MHC1 we have seen already interacts with CD8 T cells, which will be cytotoxic effectors. MHC2 interacts with a kind of helper T cells, which are basically regulatory T cells, which will not be functional in terms of cytotoxicity or secretion of antibodies. They don't secrete antibodies, they are T cells. They will secrete only interleukins eventually, but regulatory. They don't interact normally with the pathogens themselves or the infected cells. And here, there is a B cells, okay. So I'm sorry here, I did not label the MHC, so that's the answer to your question. That's the MHC1 and then the MHC2. Yeah, so that's the MHC, but that's the class 1, and that's the class 2.
The square is the T cell receptor.
The square is the T cell receptor, yeah. But the T cell receptor are the same ones, I mean. Alpha beta receptors can recognize complex with MHC1 or with MHC2. But what is very important is that these two MHC have very different functions. The MHC1 we have seen is to survey the inside of the cells. The MHC2 is really for only the regulation of the whole system. So MHC2, it's only expressed in antigen presenting cells, so basically this kind of cells that digest, it's really informational. It digests the pathogen and educate this special type of cells that after will help these effector cells, which are B cells and CD8 cells, to proliferate in the good context. This is very important because you can imagine that we have seen that the pathogen peptides are presented by these cells, but the normal peptides too. The normal peptides are presented. And how is there a discrimination between activating the cells that present a normal or a non-pathogenic peptide deals with basically the presence of these CD4 cells. That's why when you don't have any CD4 cells, like in HIV, you can have B cells, you can have CD8 cells, you don't do a lot of antibodies, you don't do any more cytotoxic cells, you don't have a lot of immunity left. So this signal, people call this the contact between these CD4 cells and the dendritic cells, but either the contact with the dendritic cells with all these cells, like an immunological synapse, so getting the information from the pathogen, transmitting it to the T cells and the B cells. So what occurs after we have seen is a clonal expansion. So these cells will expand if they are specifically stimulated, this one too, this one too. So basically there are three signals for each of these cells. So the first signal is the presence of the antigen. It's compulsory signal. Here, here, and here through the B cell receptor with the particulate antigens. The second signal is this antigen is presented into by presenting cells and not by any kind of cells. That means that the cells are informed, there is a second signal that say, I am a presenting cell, I am a specialized presenting cell that I have internalized the pathogen and I present this to you. It's not any kind of cell. The cells which are present in the context of the initial information and which are educated for this, they have received some signal of inflammation at the beginning. That's very important, this second signal. And the third signal, that's two. And the third signal is the overall context of the response. For instance, is there helper T cells around, and this gives a third signal of activation. We can see that in terms of transcription factor to the T cells, for instance. So here, it's a little bit complex, but it's just to show two different an activation of the T cell, the CD4 cells, in fact. Okay, which can go into basically two states. That's a decision, which are called TH1 and TH2, which are the most studied differentiation of the T helper state of the T helper cells. And what you see here, first signal, the contact with the receptor through the TCR kind of things. And the final results here is a production of interferon gamma. Okay. Second signal, what we call the co-stimulatory molecules, which comes from an interaction with the dendritic cell itself. And the third signal is environment, which is defined generally by cytokines. So here I'll put more, okay, these interleukins. And everything is integrated here. And you see that's quite complex and it's very not well known. I mean, a lot is still to do there. How these signals will be integrated and trigger the production of interferon gamma, for instance. We have some clues, but it's quite a lot to do, especially when you compare with the decision for making IL-4, for instance. So the same T cells basically can go these two ways. And you see that's sometimes the same, quite a lot of transcription factor are common. And the signals here, 1, 2, 3, is that it's quite similar, but it's not similar. So meaning that
what are we seeing here? Here we are seeing a decision process. What kind of decisions are being made?
Here is the T cells interacting with the dendritic cells, which has to decide, say it will secrete interferon gamma or it will secrete IL-4.
And what is the difference in terms of the outcome?
The outcome is TH1 response are more stimulatory response, and TH2 response are more tolerogenic or allergenic response.
But it's a new principle which we have not spoken about so far. It is immune cells, when stimulated, not only respond by themselves, but also send messages to other immune cells in the form of a soluble
messenger
that goes between the cells. Is that the point?
It's not the same. It's not a new principle. The other principle does not exist.
Okay.
A cell never proliferates because it has its antigen receptor, which is touched. It's exactly the opposite, generally. When a B cell receives only, or a T cell receives only this signal, it dies, apoptosis. And this is a very important point, because imagine you have one B cell somewhere in your tissue, which is not an inflammatory tissue. So probably it's a normal tissue. So if the B cell encounter here an antigen, I mean, it should be a self antigen. So it's tolerized.
And what makes it survive?
It doesn't survive.
No, what makes it survive in the alternative scenario?
The alternative scenario is the presence of co-stimulatory molecules which are specifically expressed by antigen-presenting cell in the context of inflammation, and additional signals like interleukins then can also sign a context of inflammation, of proliferation. It's very complex at the level of interleukins because it's integrated with all the immune cells.
So there is a flow chart which is simple-minded for high school students that says, touch me and I will make antibodies.
So that's not true anymore.
But again, you can simplify to saying you need 2-point touch.
touch here and touch there.
Three.
Or three. And then they talk to each other and make the immune response.
Exactly. You need the three signals. So that's why we call that a synapse, you know. It's not so simple. It's getting more and more complex. Because this signal...
There are two kinds of responses here.
No.
Right is a response.
It's the same.
No.
I mean, you should forget the difference between the B cell receptor and the T cell receptor.
No,
it's the same signal processing in the same kind of decisions. It's a little bit different in the maturation of cells and so on. But any cells need two signals at least to proliferate in the antigen way. I mean, I'm responding to a pathogen. Because I mean, this is very important to, and apparently this is the basis of the recognition of self, of the tolerance of self.
One way is because it binds and sticks. And the other way, what is that?
You must have the antigen present, so stimulation of the antigen receptor, which is quite normal. I mean, it should be specific. Okay. The second with the co-stimulatory molecules that can be independent, complementary. It's now recognized that on dendritic cells you have specialized molecules that give this co-stimulation signal to T cells and eventually to B cells.
That's not all cells.
That's only the professional presenting cells, which are basically dendritic cells, but also little bit macrophages and things like this. So these cells
cannot be.
No. And it's very important because this cell says to the B cell and the T cells, I am presenting you an antigen in the context of an invasion, basically. In the context of an inflammation which has been initially, as we have seen before, triggered by the rupture of the skin or things like this.
So the cell that sends this specific encoded message is the dendritic cell or the CD4 cell?
Dendritic.
And what does the CD4 cell say?
Okay. So now it depends if you are here at the primary response or secondary response. And the CD4 cells, they can give a signal that replaces this into the secondary response. That means that you, in the secondary response, you can make antibodies directly if you have a helper cell without all this story of presentation and anything. It's educated. We know that these antigens come from a pathogen because the first time it has been presented into the inflammation context. Okay. CD4 cell make a lot of things, we cannot talk here, but that's the essential point, which is not only the specificity for the antigen, but the context of inflammation.
In the crosstalk between CD4, we see that dendritic and CD4, dendritic and CD8, talk by cell-cell contact mediated by antigen presenting. MHC on one side, T cell on the other side.
So
but the red arrows mark 3 and 4.
Yeah.
Are soluble molecules that go from one cell to another?
Can be both. And this comes to immunological networks. If you want networks, you can be happy here. Because, I mean, for instance, let's say at the B cell level, talking between the B cell and.
T cell, you can rotate T cell with T cell everywhere.
No, because B cells, they don't recognize the antigen on the dendritic cells because B cells recognize the soluble form antigen. So particulate stuff here, but they receive signals from the dendritic cell environment, which is really organized into the lymph nodes. It's very specialized structures that put these cells together at the right time in terms of response. So B cells, for instance, I mean, this MHC2 protein is very important. For instance, if B cell, take a B cell, there's an antibody, okay, an antigen. The antigen is coming here. So B cell can internalize this antigen, degrades it, and present peptide in MHC2 context, okay? Why MHC2? Because it's antigens that come from outside, basically. That's the rule. Outside MHC2, inside MHC1. So now T cell, T helper cell, that has been educated by dendritic cells to recognize this MHC2 peptide complex, can give a direct help by cell-to-cell interaction, okay? But it can also send interleukins or anything like this. But there is the TCR of these T cells is specific for the peptides, which come from the same antigen that has been recognized before. So this is a kind of interaction, contact interaction between B and T cells, okay? Meaning that you need to make an antibody, if this step is required, you need at the same time the soluble antigen original and the helper T cells that has been educated. So these are probably mechanisms that avoids to make self antibodies, because imagine you have here your soluble self protein. If your T cell has not been educated to recognize the peptide coming from this protein, it will not make a response, basically. So these are controlling steps. So you see that, I mean, these kind of signals are integrated by T cells, by B cells too. And what's very important is how it ends. Okay. So that's a basic model for a T cell. So you have naive T cells, basically, primary exposure. Okay. So there's an activation. We've got an activated T cell. That's what makes the lymph nodes inflate. And you must have a kind of stop signal, either because there is no more antigen here. So if there is no more antigen, we call it passive apoptosis. Okay, there is no more stimulation, there is no more context of inflammation, the T cell should stop. So that was at the end of the immune response. But there is also a mechanism for persistent antigen. I mean, if the antigen is persistent and the cells should not go activation and activation and activation, otherwise first they will eventually colonize all your immune system and displace your other cells, which can be interesting, and it can give the injury to tissues and things like this. So there is an active apoptosis which is antigen dependent, and if it lasts too long, the cells are programmed to death. Okay, so the regulation of this is quite complex too. So you see that at each step of the development, first here during the activation, during the sustained activation in the presence of antigen, the T cells has to integrate all these signals and make different decisions. So it's and this is not very well known yet, because it depends on this network of transcription factors, which basically a developmental problem like in the sea ocean, so not very well known. Okay, now I will ask you a question. Why do we have memory, immune memory? There is a little paradox. There is a little paradox in the memory. If you see a pathogen for the first time and you survive, I mean, during the first encounter like this, you will not mount a memory response. So if you die, you don't need memory, obviously. If you don't die, you don't need memory because you survived the first time. It's not an obvious question. You survived the first time.
But you don't survive the second time. Even if you want to survive all the time, you want to be very healthy.
Yeah, but look now. Look. The flu, for instance. You've got the flu every year, you know. So, I mean, of course, if you're getting older, it's maybe problematic, but No, it's not a special case. All the pathogens are variations of other pathogens, basically. It's quite common. We have hundreds of this rotavirus, you know, which gives you the cold. And okay. No, it's not an obvious question.
But it evolves away from what the immune system saw. I mean, vaccines work because the organism doesn't mutate away, but in influenza, it mutates away so that it's no longer recognizable by previous immune responses.
Yes, but the principle of natural vaccine, I mean, it's not engineered. You first have a first contact with a pathogen. If it's a really serious pathogen, what you need is innate immunity. Okay? Innate immunity, instantaneous. This is important. And if it's a chronic pathogen or something like it's not life threatening.
You seem to have something against specific immune response.
It's not me, the theory which is developed by Zinker Nagel, which is a Nobel Prize. No, that's one point. That even if a disease is not life-threatening, but it's only handicapping, that's true. That in a wide world, without social insurance, it's very useful to have immunity in the adult life. That's one point, but that's immunity for, would say, non-life-threatening disease. Okay. No, but for instance, now to have some element of questions, I should give you a little bit more data. For instance, for virus protection, it appears that virus protection is mainly based on the innate immunity, which are basically germline encoded antibodies. So the initial protection against viruses, the germline encoded antibodies. This has been experimentally a weak effect, but these viruses, I mean viruses in general, but especially not the envelope ones, which are a little bit like cells, but protein viruses, have highly repetitive antigenic structure at the surface. I mean, it's geometric constructions, and even low affinity germline antibodies are very efficient to neutralize these viruses. So our first line of defense against pathogenic cytolytic viruses is innate antibodies. So germline encoded antibodies without maturation.
But there seems to be a faulty logic. Let me try to say what I get from your point. You say there are cases where we have only use primary immune response. Antigens that change and new strains that come about. And perhaps even viruses always are like that.
Life threatening.
So then, I don't know if it's life threatening or not, if we can discuss. But there are cases
which
you cannot use a secondary response. You say, therefore, I would like to pose the question to you, why do you need the secondary response at all?
Exactly.
See the logic of this. Because in which the secondary response works, it's definitely effective.
Okay, so people generally now, you have cytopathic viruses. Cytopathic viruses, viruses, for instance, that will lyse your cells and be proliferate, quite generally life-threatening, rapid infection and so on. And you have non-cytopathic, non-lytic, if you want, viruses, like, I don't know, retroviruses or things like this, which you can keep. What you need is to control, and parasites the same, you need to control. It's not life-threatening very fast. So you have time to mount an immunity. So basically, these viruses are controlled by T cells. Because what's important there is to control the proliferation of the viruses inside already infected cells, okay? Here, what is important is antibodies, because what's important is to prevent cells to be infected, because once they are infected, it's too late, okay? So now, with this, you can live with. So it's important to control better and better. So you need a T cell memory, okay? Which is good because it will give you more power along your life to treat with this. Okay? But for this, what you need is natural antibodies. But, and this is a very interesting theory, I think, you know that the antibodies goes from the mother to the offspring during the fetal life. So the memory here would be interesting to protect the babies during their babies at the beginning of their life, they are a little bit immunological immature because the shaping of the repertoire takes quite a lot of time, and they are very sensitive to infection, and that's why in mammal, even in birds, you have antibody in the eggs. In mammals, you have antibodies that goes to the fetus, or if they don't go directly from the mother to the fetus, they go. You eat them in your first milk, colostrum. For example, in a bovine. There is no transfer of antibody to the fetus, but all the antibodies are in the first milk, which should be taken by the baby, I don't know how it's called. And this can protect for the initial years. So the theory is that for antibodies, we have an immunity essentially to pass it to the babies. Okay. And we have also in males, because it's difficult to make maybe a system which is only efficient for females. It's an interesting hypothesis. And for T cells, it's more obvious why you need a memory. It's because you have to live with this organism, which basically makes chronic infection. I mean, parasites are very difficult to get rid of it. And HIV is a good example, and herpes virus, or whatever you can. But there is a lot of virus which we live with chronically and we control only. For this, memory is interesting. Open questions. So now networks, we have seen that we have a lot of networks. Time for last things. Sizing, shaping the repertoire. At the T cell level at least. Yeah, 5 minutes. So when the T cells are in the thymus, you random generation of this T cell receptor. So how is it sorted out? So self-reactive and the non-self-reactive. Okay, basically, so there are many theories, but that's the that's the percentage of survival. So there is a theory of negative selection and positive selection, meaning that a T cell will go out of the thymus if it recognizes a little bit the MHC proteins, because otherwise it's not useful. And if it doesn't recognize too much self-peptides, so it's a kind of bell shape, that's the affinity, that's the survival of the T cells. So if the affinity is too low, so the affinity for what? I mean, we are in the thymus, so it's only self-antigens. So it's the affinity for MHC plus self-peptides, okay? If it's too low, the T cell is negative selection. In fact, this is positive selection because it should recognize a little bit the MHC proteins. And this is negative because if it recognizes too much self-peptides, it goes out. And the miracle of the diversity is probably that the remaining ones make a repertoire which is dense enough to recognize any other kind of peptide. So this makes interesting calculation, because we know, for instance, that one TCR approximately recognize something like 10 to the 5 random peptides. If you take random peptides, one TCR will recognize 10 to the 5 in the context of one MHC molecule, okay? And now the opposite way. If you take one antigen, one peptide in one MHC molecule, it's known in mice that you will have approximately 100 TCR. So if you take one peptide plus MHC, you will generate 10 to the 2 different TCR. Okay? So now try to take this this data and calculate the optimal size of the repertoire and what kind of affinity should be selected. And I mean, some people play with that. It's interesting. You had a question, Terry, which was interesting. Yeah. It was, is there the response the same with different affinities? Huh? For T cell, it's clear it is not. I mean, oops. If the affinity is here, the theory is that with very low affinity, it's enough to maintain the naive cell alive. Just, it's enough signal to keep you alive. If you go here, you will, synthesize some interleukins. If you go here, you will proliferate. And eventually, if you go too high, you will apoptose. So, and this is the big work now of immunologists, to trying to find the conditions of what makes different affinity or different kinetics into the T-cell signaling.
Imagine trial immunity.
Sorry?
How is this inherited or not?
That's interesting, because the presence of the MHC system, which makes the baby different from the mother, makes that the cellular immunity, you cannot pass it to the babies. It's not the same MHC background. So the only thing you can pass eventually is antibodies. Okay. We could imagine that if we were histocompatible, we could inherit some cells too. And that's all the secondary effect. Why?
Yeah, I didn't understand.
So the histocompatibility problem?
Yeah. Why is that good?
Why is that good that we are not? Okay, the relationship with the two is here. If a virus has found a way in me to escape MHC proteins, he has made a sequence that avoids any peptide presentation. If I infect you, I mean, you have the same.
Yeah.
Okay. If you have different MHC proteins,
it is more variety.
So we protect each other, in fact. Okay. But the T cell here. The T cell here. As it's this one. It will recognize a complex of my MHC. Your T cell will recognize a complex of my MHC with any kind of peptide. So that's alloreactivity. Okay?